I'd like you to consider this reading by Robert Fulton. It is simply entitled, Stuff. Moving is a blow to my image. I like to think that I am reasonably clean and tidy, but when it comes to that moment when all the furniture and possessions have been removed from my rooms, and I come back to see if I've left anything, and I look at the floor, and there's all this stuff around. Behind where the desk was, and behind where the bookcase was, and behind where the bed was, and in the corner occupied by the chest. Stuff. Gray. Fuzzy. Grotty stuff. Look at that dirt, I think. I am not so very nice and clean after all, I think. What would the neighbors think, I think? What would my mother say, I think? What if they come to inspect, I think? I've got to clean up quick, I think. This stuff, it's always there when I move. What is it? Well, I read in a medical journal that a laboratory analyzed this stuff. They were working on the problems of people with allergies, but their results apply here. The finding? Particles of food, particles of wool, cotton, paper, bug chunks, plants, tree leaves, ash, microscopic spores of fungi, single-celled animals, and lots of unidentifiable odds and ends, most of it natural and organic. But that is just the miscellaneous list. You see, the majority of stuff comes from just two sources. People, your exfoliated skin and hair, and meteorites. Meteorites, I'm not kidding. Tons of this stuff falls every day and becomes stuff. So in other words, what I've got behind my bed and my dresser and my bookcase and my chest is mostly me and stardust. Now, a botanist told me that if you gather up a bunch of that stuff and put it in a jar and put some water in it and let it sit in the sunlight and plant a seed in it, the seed will grow like crazy. And in fact, that if you put spores in it, put it in a nice damp place, mushrooms will grow in it. And then, if you eat the mushrooms, you will see stars. Also, if you really want to see a lot of it, you take a sheet off your bed, shake it really hard in a dark room, and then turn on a beamed flashlight, and there you are. Like that little snowman in the round glass globe on the mantel at Grandma's house. London Bridge is falling down. And I am falling down. And the stars are falling down. And we're all falling down. Going around, some say. Scientists have pretty well established that we come from a stellar birthing room. We are the stuff of stars. And there behind my desk, I seem to be returning to my source in a quiet way, recombining with the stuff of the universe into who knows what. And now I have a heightened respect for what's going on in the nooks and crannies of my very own room, because that isn't dirt. It's cosmic compost.
And thank you for this very grand opportunity. And Deborah, for the opportunity to share your pulpit. And actually, the pulpit, I guess, of the Deacon congregation, because from the get-go, we all knew this was the congregation's place. And I am deeply grateful for your gracious hospitality while I'm here. And for the opportunity to be a part of this significant celebration and to have been present at your birthing and to have been a part of that birthing. Anniversaries are important celebrations. They are opportunities to celebrate the past, the water that has gone under the bridge. And there are opportunities to envision a new future. So, my hope for you as a congregation is that indeed this will be far more than a celebration of the past, but a new vision of a different kind of future for you. In the 1950s, there arose a growing awareness of an ignored truth. You cannot do just one thing. Every human action on the globe has a consequence. We began looking at this principle in terms of the whole planetary system of earth and water and air and plants and animals. And we looked at the destruction we humans were heaping on the planet's ecological balance and its capacity to continue sustaining itself, and we became disturbed. And this disturbance organized itself into what became known as the ecology movement, an attempt to correct our abusive tendencies toward our environment. The word ecology derives from the Greek word oikos, which means household. The ecology movement forced us to begin seeing our planet and ourselves as a family of mutually affecting relationships. This new vision created concern for how human actions were beginning to have a negative effect on our future. But while this concern caused us to start taking much needed corrective action toward how we treated the environment, it remained utilitarian and stopped short of curbing those actions that were designed to improve our quality of living. We still saw humans as the head of the household and all its other members as servants to our needs. Our concern was over destroying the domestic system that would provide us, humans, with an abundant future. In brief, our relationship continued to be driven by human-centered visions. For this reason, the ecology movement, for all of its value, failed to curb the greed motivations that continue at this moment to destroy our planetary environment. I hate dry sermons. Here's the bottom line. Our planet will survive as it has survived all past threats to its existence. What will not survive is the human enterprise. To change this obvious outcome, we must create and commit to a new view of reality that has the power to overcome the motivation of greed. And here's the catch. Any new way of relating that will transform our relationship with the environment and offer us humans a new future must be done for the sake of the planet as well as for the sake of humans. In brief, it cannot be grounded any longer in utilitarianism. Such a view has been seeking to emerge in our midst for 40 years, but we have failed to define it with clarity or model its potential for human transformation. For want of a better description, this view can be called spirituality. Actually, spirituality is not a new perspective in human history. It is indeed as old as human history. But we moderns have ignored it because the vehicles of its conveyance have smacked of superstition and scientific ignorance. To those of us wonderfully educated, know-it-all, arrogant liberals. So I want to seek to reframe it in a manner that possibly makes sense to us humans. And I begin with this quotation. How fortunate are you and I whose home is timelessness? We who have wandered down from fragrant mountains of eternal now to frolic in such mysteries as birth and death a day, or maybe even less. This poetic observations, E.E. Cumming, puts his finger on the critical issue of human existence, our inability to penetrate the mystery which birthed us and sustains us. Nevertheless, as compulsive meaning makers, we're driven by our nature to know this mystery. And in order to squeeze meaning from it, we ask it the compelling questions that which have been the historical focus of religion. Here is a core version, which Joyce already related to you. Who am I? And this is the question about the nature of my identity. How do I know what I know? And this is a question about my source of authority. Who or what's in charge? Which is a question about my ultimate value. What's my purpose? Which is a question about my life direction. And what does my death mean? Which is a question about the boundaries of time in my existence. So important are the answers to these questions that they combine into my beliefs, my view of reality. They become the touchstone of every meaning I create for how I relate to myself, to others, and the universe. They determine who I love, why I love, what I love, how I love. They choreograph my frolic in the mystery from cradle to grave. The problem is that I cannot prove any of my answers to these compelling questions. When I seek to prove their validity, I am pushed over the edge of reason to free fall in faith. However, there's one factor of mystery that is provable by both science and simple observation, namely that the universe will not stop changing. This stability of change surrounds us and is within us. Remember when you were 10 years old? No? Remember the shape of your body? Remember how much hair you had? And its color? The artist Pablo Picasso understood the work of an artist as being anchored in this stability of constant change. And he says, every act of creation is first of all an act of destruction. In brief, nothing can be created without something else being destroyed. I cannot eat, drink, or breathe without participating in this process of destruction creation. Nothing that presently exists could be what it is without this process. We all came out of the bowels of destruction. All industry relies on its capacity to destroy one thing in order to create something else. This process of destruction creation is the universal constant. We call it change. But with this notion of destruction creation background, I ask this question, what is spirituality? And the answer to this question roots in the answer to one of the compelling questions of mystery, which I mentioned earlier. And the question is, who or what is in charge? In the West, this tends to be the God question. But in the East, it might be the Allah question or the Buddha question. Or it can simply be the universe question. The point is that it is really the question about my ultimate value by whatever name I might choose to ascribe it. Traditionally, humans have answered this question from the perspective of themselves as the center of the universe. That is, everything in the universe exists to serve human whim. And this has been the case, even if the assertion is that some God is in charge. No group of people in history has been more destructive to their environment than those who claim the name of Krishna, who also claim the name of God. Spirituality reverses this perspective and views humans as one infinitesimal part of a large, unfathomable whole. The answer to the question about who or what is in charge is that the universe is in charge of itself by whatever name we call it. It is its own ultimate value. It needs no rationale for existence. It just is. And it is an eternal process of destruction, creation. It is cosmic compost. So fundamental to spirituality, then, is the notion that everything that exists in the universe is made of the same stuff. This is the very ground of the process of destruction, creation, of change. Albert Einstein's famous mathematical equation, E equals mc squared, captures this truth scientifically. Theoretical physicist Heinz Pagel says the meaning of this equation is that energy and the forms energy takes are the same thing. Science calls it energy. The more popular metaphor is stardust. Robert Fulghum calls it cosmic compost. But whatever we choose to call it, whatever the form it takes, a baby, a rock, a flower, a star, everything is made of the same stuff, and all of these forms are in the process of destruction, creation, of being transformed. The poetic description we Unitarian Universalists use to describe these meshing relationships is the interdependent web of existence. My, how we love the poetry of that phrase. But its more accurate and graphic description is food chain. Whatever we call it, everything that exists is living off of everything else that exists. The reason is that since everything is made of the same stuff, it can become anything else at any moment. The universe is a holistic, interdependent web that is constantly transforming its own being by transforming the beings that are within it. Here are two of the basic premises, then, that undergird this view of reality called spirituality. And the first one is that since the universe and everything in it is made of the same stuff, then humans are kin to everything that exists. Humans come from the same womb as all else and share the same universal genes. The forms of the universe are a cosmic family. Therefore, if one part is holy, all parts are holy. Indeed, spirituality takes this view. All of creation is holy. Whatever it is that's holy in our experience, it is holy because we declare it to be so and for no other reason. And spirituality declares all that exists to be holy. This means that the attitude of utilitarianism is an affront to the universe. It is the primal human sin. Whether it is expressed toward humans or the environment of our living, This also means that the only legitimate response of humans toward each other and the environment is a stewardship that seeks to enhance a mutual well-being. In brief, humans should treat the universe for what it is, the womb and sustainer of existence, as holy. Spirituality recognizes that survival requires mutual destruction in the web. But it also believes that engaging this destruction should be done with reverence and a sense of non-utilitarian gratitude and humility and without self-centered wantonness. Thus, respect for the web is insufficient. There must be a reverence that appropriately honors the nature of all creation. It is only such an attitude that can surmount the motivations of human greed. Again, Albert Einstein aptly summarizes it when he says, to teach a child not to step on a caterpillar is as good for the child as the caterpillar. In Alice Walker's Pulitzer Prize winning novel, The Color Purple, Chug Avery, the character that makes love come alive and who represents the color purple, speaks a line that is a metaphor for a genuine spiritual relationship with creation. She says, I know that if I cut a tree, my arm will bleed. I know if I cut a tree, my arm will bleed. The second premise of spirituality is that since everything in creation is made of the same stuff, then communication between its various forms can occur. For humans, this means that we can have a personal relationship with creation without reducing it to human attributes. We do not have to recreate the universe in human image to commune together. All we have to do is open ourselves to what it has to reveal to us. It speaks through its energy and we speak through ours. We speak the same language because we're made of the same stuff. I'll expand on this meaning just a little later, but first let me answer some pertinent questions. And the first question is, what is spirituality? And the answer is that it is a way of relating stardust to stardust, energy to energy, or if you please, spirit to spirit. All of our most profound relationships are spiritual. Love's an example. Love is an attempt to know another person beyond physical and verbal limitation. It's an attempt to enter the spirit of that person, to commune with the energy of their being. This means that spirituality is not a practice, such as meditation or yoga or some religious ritual, although such things may very well facilitate spiritual relating. Rather, spirituality is a relationship of being to being, stardust to stardust, spirit to spirit. Here's a second question. Is spirituality catching? What if I don't want it? The answer is implicit in all that I've shared. Jacqueline Small says it this way. We're not human beings learning to be spiritual. We're spiritual beings learning to be human. Again, we can call the stuff we're made of cosmic compost, stardust, energy, spirit. Doesn't make any difference. Spirit is good as word as any to describe the energies all forms in creation exude, which they do. We humans are more than a composite of parts of flesh and bone and nerves. We are synergistic beings of spirit or energy. We can see humans as mere matter if we wish, but matter is ultimately nothing more than a word that describes the nature of the forms by which the universe expresses itself. So in whatever way we seek to reduce the universe to the limited dimensions of human understanding, we end up with a handful of inexplicable mystery. We end up with the word spirit being as valid as any other word to describe that stuff that comprises the universe. So the answer to the question is, you cannot catch what you already are. The third question is, is being spiritual, do I have to give up humanism? Humanism is a noble view of reality about relating to other humans as worthy of fairness and compassion and expressions of equality. But it does have a serious flaw. It tends to place humans at the center of the universe and make them the highest value. After all, that's what its very name means. Spirituality does not ask that humanist values be laid aside. Quite the contrary. It asks that we embrace the entire universe with the same sense of worth, fairness, and compassion. Indeed, it asks that we do more than that for both humans and the universe. It asks that we relate to everything as holy. It asks that all our relating be imbued with reverence. So the request is not for humanists to give up their values, rather to expand the scope of these values to include the universe. Now come back to the belief that we humans can commune with all forms of creation spirit. Spirit, how is this possible? It's possible because of the wonderful gift the universe has bestowed upon humans called mind. Our mind has two capacities. One's reason. Reason enables us to add, subtract, divide, multiply our experience so as to create meaning. Reason enables us to verbally communicate, to make order out of our experience, to translate the messages of our physical senses into skill and survival. With reason, we become meaning makers. We create our beliefs, invent our conscience, make choices, live deliberately. Spirituality recognizes that reason is essential to being human. The other capacity is intuition. Intuition enables us to know what reason and our physical senses cannot tell us. The universe is full of energy signals from all that is within it. Through technology, we have invented ways to harness some of these signals. This is what radar and sonar, radar, television, telephones, all the cyberspace stuff is all about, with which you'd not be able to communicate with your friends while you're listening to a sermon or text message or do anything else that kids, young adults do nowadays. It all has to do with energy signals that we've been able to technologically capture. Intuition is our mind's natural energy antenna. Through intuition, we can pick up the energy signals of other beings transmitted in our environment and give them labels. Sometimes we call this being in tune, being in sync. We talk about feeling the spirit of a crowd. We sense danger in our environment. We sometimes know who's calling on the phone before we pick up the receiver. Everything in our environment is not only made of energy, it is vibrating that energy into the atmosphere around it. Intuition is our mind's ability to pick up these energy transmissions. Even truth or falsehood has a certain energy aura, and we can distinguish between the two when another person is talking. Or we can know if someone else is happy or sad without words being spoken. We call this energy transmission mood. But not only are we capable of picking up the energy that emits from other humans, we can pick up the energy that exudes from animals and plants and other forms in the environment, because everything in existence is made of vibrating energy throwing off signals consistent with its being. Problem is, in the Western world, we're taught from birth to disregard and distrust our intuition and rely solely on our reason. And fortunate for you women, you were given the privilege of being intuitive in the Western world. Spirituality asserts that as marvelous and critical to our existence as reason might be, intuition is equally important. Moreover, intuition moves us into a sphere of knowing that is denied reason. Mindfulness is permitting ourselves to be fully human by letting both reason and intuition instruct our living. Intuition not only opens us to what our environment has to speak, but balances out the limited mathematics of reason with a greater knowing. Indeed, were we to strip away what intuition communicates to us on a daily basis, we could not survive as a species. The universe gifted us humans with intuition for a reason. If we wish to know what the universe offers us, then we must reinstate the validity of intuition in our living. And beyond that, if we wish to have a profound spiritual relationship with our environment, then intuition is the pathway. So here's a closing story that illustrates this assertion. Early in the 1800s, in the days when the great fleets of sailing ships went out of New Bedford to scour the oceans of the world for whale oil, the most famous skipper of them all was Eleazar Hull. Now, Captain Hull took his vessel into more remote seas, brought home greater quantities of whale oil, and lost fewer crewmen in the process than any other master of his time. And all of this was the more remarkable because he had no formal education in navigational training of any kind. And when asked how he guided his ship infallibly over the desert of waters, he would reply, "Well, I go up on the deck, I listen to the wind and the rigging, I get the drift of the sea, take a long look at the stars, then I set my course." One day, however, the march of time caught up with the ancient mariner. The insurance company, whose agents covered the vessels of Captain Hull's employers, declared that they would no longer write a policy for any ship whose master did not meet certain formal standards of education in the science of navigation. Captain Hull's superiors could understand this new rule, but they were at a loss as to how to approach the proud man whose life had been spent on the bridge and tell him he must go back to school or retire. So after some consultation, they decided that they would meet the problem head on, and three of the company's top executives waited on Captain Hull, presenting him their dilemma as tactfully as possible. And to their amazement, the old fellow responded enthusiastically. He had, it appeared, always wanted to know something about science and was entirely willing to spend several months studying it. So the arrangements were made. Eleazar Hull went to school, studied hard, graduated near the top of his class, returned to the ship, set out to sea, was gone for 2 years. When the skipper's friends heard that he was putting into port again, they met him in an informal delegation at the docks, and they inquired eagerly how it felt to navigate by the book after so many years of doing it the other way. "It was wonderful," Captain Hull responded. "Whenever I wanted to know my position, I go to my cabin, get out all the charts, work through the proper equations, and set a course with mathematical precision. Then I go up on the deck, get the drift of the sea, listen to the wind and the rigging, take a long look at the stars, and correct my computation for error." Intuition is our pathway into spiritual connections. The Welsh call such connections a thin place, a seam in the fabric of the universe, where we enter its very nature, where we are immersed in the holy, where individual identity momentarily is dissolved into unity, where for one moment we become the whole rather than the part, where we know that we relate in kinship with all that exists. But I cannot stay in this state and remain human. So I slip back through this seam into the form of myself, yet I'm different. For I now know the meaning of the words of Unitarian Universalist minister and poet Carl J. Nelson. "Nothing at last is sacred, but each act, each thought, and each living thing. Reality resides in host, among whose number I too am found. No thought evokes more wonder, nor greater reverence." Is there a way to redeem the womb of our existence from the utilitarian greed that threatens the human enterprise with genocide? Yes, we can embrace the universe and ourselves within it as a holy family, acknowledging that every moment of our living is owed to the artistry of creation destruction and is therefore a frolic in profound grace. Amen.